Hello, this is Matt Buller from Buller's Desk. This week's political podcast is our Comic-Con special. I know that there's a lot going on politically with the mayor. And for what we do, I kind of feel like it's a little bit important for us to get a little bit of perspective. Right now, it seems to be all about TV news and breaking news and how Donna Frye yelled at Bob Filner and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not saying it's not important. It's just that for what we're doing, for this kind of thing, you want to get a little bit of perspective. And you can't really get perspective without having let the events unfold. So, we hopefully will get to this at some point next week. But until then, we did touch on it a little bit. So it's interesting to hear how we talked about it. And this week, though, was our Comic-Con special. We were over, Rick Epps and I, we're over with Jamie Newbold at Southern California Comics. This place is really pretty cool. It's got comics and graphic novels and collectible toys everywhere. Although Jamie had some very interesting things to say about it, say about the comic industry, say about politics in the comic industry, and the politics of Comic-Con, which there's a lot more that goes on in that and on with that than I think anybody in that field a lot of times wants to talk about, because you don't want to get, you know, people get afraid of repercussions, they don't want to speak out of turn, all kinds of stuff. So it's a very political world. And that world, Comic-Con in particular, has an effect on San Diego politics specifically. So we talked a little bit about that, a little bit about literacy, all kinds of stuff. Pulled some of the more interesting little clips, put them on our YouTube, and they should be on the bowlersdesk.com as well. So be sure and check that out if you want to see us chatting, see what we look like. I had my Batman shirt on because it was a Comic-Con themed show. And also remember to, subscribe to our iTunes feed. So, you know, you can always get updated if you get on our iTunes page. But other than that, bowlersdesk.com is the place to go for this. And this political podcast was the Comic-Con special. And as always, if you want to hop on your soapbox, hop on ours. Call 619-663-4531. Leave a message. Tell us what you think. If you agree with Rick, if you disagree with Rick, if you have a question for me, if you disagree with me, if you just want to share your opinion, feel free to call. Leave us a message. We're interested in what people have to say. 619-663-4531. Political podcast from bowlersdesk.com. Comic-Con special.
He's going to make himself look worse if he doesn't.
What's really going to be interesting is who the hell is going to come replace his staff?
Yeah.
He can't operate as a mayor without a staff.
Yeah.
He has no chief of staff.
Yeah.
Who the hell's coming on board because he's worked so hard to alienate one half of the political stream, and now the other half thinks he's a pervert?
Yeah.
Who the fuck's coming on board?
Yeah. That's that's the thing. And this apology message here,
I begin today,
I'm playing
by
a little bit of in the background.
You
know, you can't hear it, but you know, he says my behavior's been bad up until this point. So does that mean for the past 30 years he's been behaving like this? And I talked to somebody who worked in Bill Brave's office in Congress,
and realized,
and she was two doors down from him in Congress, and she says that
I am embarrassed to admit
this is how he behaved when he was in Congress, and nobody said anything because.
Oh, sorry.
People don't want to lose their jobs.
My knee,
you know, people don't want to. They don't want to get blacklisted.
It's one thing for his apology to say like you're Austin Powers and you woke up and you didn't know that was wrong. But you know, people change through the years. You don't just stay in one mindset for the whole.
He has though.
Yeah. Well, this is what they're saying. They're saying this is the way he's been the whole time he's been in Congress. That he's behaved this way. Now, which is like, you know, everybody's. The reason everybody's upset about it is because it comes off totally hypocritical, because he's supposed to be this guy who was arrested marching for equal rights in the South during the with Martin Luther King. You know, his mugshot is on his webpage when he got arrested.
He wasn't fighting for women's rights, though.
No.
I'm just saying, you know what I mean?
But still, you know what I mean? So
But still, you know, that's this whole Filner thing is an easy story, I think, journalistically to turn, because they're just handing everyone the information. Nobody really has to investigate anything.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, that Paris scandal, that's one of those things that I think when it came to light, it would have died down eventually.
Yeah.
But this thing with Fry, with his chief of staff quitting, with Irene, his head media relations person quitting.
Yeah. His girlfriend leaving him.
His girlfriend dumped him. And then all this came out, and I think his girlfriend dumped him because of this, and she knew this was coming.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm sure.
And now he's going to fight it, is the thing. He's calling for an independent investigator to come in, and that there's an... The city has, an EOD office, and that it's the, equal EOD, equal opportunity something department.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're the ones that investigate all these things. So now he's saying, oh, they're going to investigate it. I don't think he's going to go away without a fight. And I think that's what's going to happen next week. They're going to come, Gonzalez and what's the other lawyer? I forget his name.
I know, that guy
in those glasses he was wearing, a lawyer with earrings on, I just do not trust. I mean, you know what I mean? I come from a family of lawyers, and I don't trust lawyers like that. Like, what's this guy? Who was this? Corey Briggs,
that's right.
Corey Briggs, yeah, because it's Briggs Law. It's his law firm
that's handling this whole thing.
Yeah. So I wonder what they're really going to bring forward next week. Because they had that press conference, and it was a big to-do.
Yeah.
But, everybody carried it live, but it didn't amount to anything.
Yeah, it's kind of like wait and see.
Yeah, it was like, oh, we've got this on you, quit now, or we release this information. Basically, it was like extortion.
Yeah.
And Filner's like, well, go ahead, release it.
Yeah.
We'll let the independent investigator handle it, and then they'll have to go through it. Whatever legal channels that they're supposed to go through. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think this story's not going away.
No, it's not. I think he's hoping the San Diegans have a short-term memory, and if he can show any type of, it's him against the world kind of thing, that maybe it's going to save him. But I feel like
he's totally out of touch with what's going on.
Yeah, I think he really is in over his head right now. I think he doesn't realize how, because of his, he has a huge ego, so...
Yeah.
The idea of how far over his head he really is, I don't think he realizes just how far over his head he is on this.
Yeah.
It's tough. This is going to be tough for him to get around.
And so what else was going on locally this week?
Let's see. What else is happening?
I know. I feel like this is the... that's coming in the future this week.
Thank goodness.
There's a little relief. So which comic book hero villain would best exemplify Filner?
The Joker.
Almost no makeup.
It's the Joker. Well, it's the Joker.
Before we have to say we're here in Southern California Comics in honor of Comic-Con, talking about, well, I guess we're talking politics, but politics and comics as well, right? How politics is expressed through comics, and Rick was saying as a kid, this is where he, through comics, was first how he learned about politics. And because there's a lot of that in a lot of comics. They deal with a lot of these bigger political, social issues in a lot of ways that I think are more palatable for kids. I actually read, was that Last Days of American Crime, and I thought that was a really interesting take on crime and American society and the justice system and the police and all that, those things and politicians and how people react. And you get a lot of that with a lot of comics, even back, way back in the, what would that be, the Golden Age? I mean, you're the expert here. You're the comicologist. Forensic comicologist.
Yes. The science of collecting comics.
Yeah.
That's the shtick.
Let me aim the mic at you right there. There we go.
Comic books have been around in a format that we understand them since the 30s, the mid-1930s. Lots of changes have occurred, and I guess one of the grandest changes of all time is that kids are not the predominant purveyors of comic books. It is not even an exclusive men's club. It is a large cross-section of people, except that the average age of these people is in their early 30s, late 20s.
So it's more about collecting and less about reading.
No, it's equal both directions.
Mm.
there are actually segments of the collecting industry that don't read new comics, and there are new comic readers who haven't picked up a comic book older than the 90s ever. Mm-hmm. There is just a unifying factor that it is an age group. That same age group that's reading new comics is the same age group that's buying old comics, but there are no kids in significant numbers coming up the ranks to replace those who disappear by age and attrition.
So what are they getting into if they're not getting
into? It's the same thing they've been into now for two decades. It's video games. These are the same kids that are lacking interest in school sports programs, or maybe they aren't. Maybe it's the same kids who are athletes. But the problem is, Rick's generation and my generation, you're hard-pressed not to find somebody who didn't read comics growing up. Now, you're hard-pressed to find somebody who actually reads comics. They all go to the comic book movies, mm-hmm. but very, very few kids read comics. And when they come in here, it's rarely a high school-age child that comes into this store. They'll go into stores that feature gaming products that is more in line with their interest, role-playing games or video. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In here, you'll see smaller children accompanying their parents, but those kids are busy playing with their little handheld electronic gaming devices while their parents are reading or shopping for comics, which has become strange because several of my employees were complaining to me last week that with the surge in small children occupying the store with their folks, my employees have found themselves being battered by small children who their parents have ignored them, and now they're babysitting these parents' kids while the parents are going through the boxes looking for comics.
So you need to have a play care someplace to drop off the kids.
If we expand this suite, we'd probably have to put in a set of playpens with bars. Because my employees do not want to be babysitters.
You have to set up a little thing like what the Y has so that you can go and drop your kid or IKEA, right? I bet if you did that, those kids would get into comics.
Hey, Jim, right? I'm curious. If there's any data out there about how many of these kids now are reading comics in e-format instead of coming in and get actual comics?
Nothing
books.
I've got my hands on.
Yeah, I'm curious about that.
Again, it's not kids.
Yeah, or even older people who can't afford the...
You know. There is a definite declination in the sales of new comic books, but that's common knowledge.
Yeah.
And there has been periods of massive sales of comic books several times that in the history of this business, not my store, the business of selling comic books, going back decades. And then there have been feast and famine, where there's been more famine than feast. And right now, we seem to be in one of those slump periods again that has been going on for a while. And the problem is, again, the lack of children. As older adults shift over to online, to digital reading, mm-hmm. and the very companies that produce comic books are my worst enemies for business, mm-hmm. because every comic book is trying to entice the reader to go digital. Hey, forget your comic book store. Yeah. Now you just buy direct from us. And we cut everybody else out of the food chain, lots of people now will lose their jobs. And you can feel the tension.
Yeah. Do you think that you have to kind of take on more of a curatorial position as far as being a part of somebody's life in that way? Does that make sense?
It does, because...
Because there's so much.
You need somebody who can talk about the stuff. We have a huge graphic novel trade paperback hardcover presence, mm-hmm. at this store. Maybe the largest selection in the county. Sure. The only other capable entity that I have to compete against at the store level would be Barnes & Noble, Bookstar, mm-hmm. a chain of bookstores. Yeah. Then the next big kid on the block would be Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yet those guys can't maintain the same variety, the same volume, and we sell this stuff like crazy because my staff talks to these people and they have thousands of questions about which trade, what should I read. It's amazing that there is a way to fight the digital mania by being able to talk to people And then they know that even if they go online, they're confused.
Yeah, so they gotta come to know, I pull up my Comixology, my app that I have here, and I half the time, I'm just looking at whatever they're giving away for free,
right.
And I'm not actually buying anything anyhow. So, I mean, because most of the time, the stuff, personally, there's very few that I'd be interested in buying because I have particular tastes, but I'm only interested in the stuff they're giving away for free, and then maybe I'll read a little bit of it and I'll go, oh, crap, I feel like I got even ripped off for the free thing because now I got this thing stuck on my iPad that I really don't want to read. Or you'll get halfway through the free thing and then realize, oh, wait a minute, they want $15 for the rest of this digital copy. Why would I spend $15 on it when I could spend that same amount of money and actually get a hard copy?
Right.
I don't understand the logic.
Well, you've got the this is the beginning of something that has already altered the way that we read books. I have a Kindle. I've been a long diehard book reader since I was a small child. My father was chairman at City College and ran the library as well for 20 years. So I'm a book guy. So my reluctance to go electronic and start downloading books is legend. But I do now. And comic books are in their baby steps along the same way. The only problem is whatever the hooks are to get you to go digital obviously remain problematic because you've said yourself there's a catch.
Yeah.
To whatever you get involved in. When they figure out how to eliminate the catches, still make money, people will just be driving towards the internet or towards Kindle or whatever you use to read, which kills stores like this.
Well, especially with younger kids having less and less to do with the handheld comics, you can see in another generation, in the next decade or so, you're going to see a lot more of that. There's a couple of things that I think are really interesting insights about this. I think, one, you know, the cost of comics for younger kids is prohibitive now, unfortunately. Not because any fault of ours, fault of them, how much they charge from the manufactured comics. When we were kids, 10, 12 cents, I'm going back a few decades or more.
10, 12 cents.
Well, yeah, when we were growing up, they were 10 or 12 cents. You know, so you could go, okay, go down, your parents give you, 25 cents for allowance, you go get a couple of comics, or you get one giant comic, and you're good to go. That's what it was in the 60s. I mean, this is how it was, But now, and then on top of that, you had, mom and pop comic shops. They weren't really comic shops. You go to the local liquor store or the local store or a little sundry store, and then they had a comic book stand inside that was in your neighborhood, so you didn't have to go anywhere, like drive someplace to get to a facility, which is wonderful, but, kids got, we were enticed because it was local to where you were. You didn't have to go anywhere to find it. Now there's a much bigger venue. It's just that now you have to get driven somewhere to get there instead of just walking around the corner to your shop to get that. Now, I think it's an unfortunate thing, and as Jamie can tell you, I've been collecting comics forever and off and on and have bought and sold collections of my own, but I love old stuff, the Silver Age stuff, which is my generation, and I also love to buy new stuff, and because I've seen the progression of comics and how they've grown up, and even now when I go back and buy the stuff that I had when I was a kid, which I still love because it's dear to me, it's so fascinating to look at it. I kind of laugh and go, wow, okay. I mean, it was so clear then, the delineation between good and evil. You know, the bad guy was really the bad guy, but he wasn't like a bad guy like would just kill millions of people. He was just a guy who was a robber or did some sort of local nefarious act, but he didn't do anything horrific. Now we have more horrific killers, and then the good guys are kind of screwed up, and Tony Stark, who we all love Iron Man, but Tony Stark's got a lot of issues, and I mean that started with the whole Marvel genre of sort of complicated heroes. That
did this anti-hero start to come in?
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Frank Miller.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Batman, Dark Knight, Strikes, Rises Again, whatever they called it. Frank Miller.
What year was that?
Mid-80s. Mid-80s. It was a four-issue prestige format graphic novel series. Takes place roughly 20 years in the future by Gotham standard time. In other words,
Gotham standard time. I love that Gotham standard time.
Well, I have to remember my Batman trivia, but I believe it's about 20 years in the future for the DC universe. Batman now therefore is 20 years older, probably roughly in his late 50s, early 60s. Yeah. He is retired from this from his lifestyle, but he's extremely angry. In other words, he's like a bitter ex-cop.
He's a grumpy
old he's a grumpy old ex-cop. Yeah. And he just hates everybody. He lives off in the dark. And then somehow he is pulled back in.
Yeah.
And he has completely changed his attitude, and he carries weapons, guns.
He's a badass. And,
well, that's always been the appeal of Batman, that he wasn't magical.
Sure. Yeah. He had a code, and the code disappears. And and frankly, Frank Miller, who's famous for 300, the movie 300, which was based on a graphic novel, and Frank has done plenty of things for our industry to bring notes to the characters, but with that Batman storyline, he introduced the darker, anti-heroic mainstream character who was unquestionably not the same character that you were familiar with.
No.
And after that, you started seeing, first you started seeing more prestige format, stories written outside of the normal comic monthly routine that had a darker, edgier quality because the industry quickly figured out, wait a minute, these guys are onto something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then not long after, Spawn, number one from Image Comics, Todd McFarlane Spawn, comes out and for the first time in the comic book world creates a brand new character that is as anti-heroic as you can get and sells unfathomable numbers of copies of this thing, and everybody gloms onto it, and it bred thousands of pieces of merchandise in its own movie, and it has quickly followed by all kinds of other angst-ridden, anti-heroic, questionable ethics, morally ambiguous superheroes.
Yeah.
And
do you think this kind of moral ambiguity is a product of the buyer being a lot more sophisticated as far as what they want, or is this a product of our age? Like, we're talking about Filner, if you're talking about moral ambiguity here, right? Earlier. You know what I mean? So is this just taking, like, it's a bigger, kind of more humanistic look at the thing? Is it how people are thinking, or is it really just reflective of our time?
I think you can pinpoint the differences between two generations. Rick and I, mid-50s. Two parents when I grew up. Stable household. My whole neighborhood, there wasn't one divorced family.
So good and evil were obvious and clear and
values,
simple.
Yeah.
Right. It was simple. And so now, by the late 80s, early 90s, you have my son's generation. And he's a product of two divorces. And there is just all of that breakdown in a certain fiber that comes with a steady family, and they see things differently. That we can talk endlessly about the sociology behind the generational change. But the social fabric for a generation has changed for all time.
Yeah.
It's doubtful that in any lifetime we're going to see no divorces or rarely see divorces and families intact all the way. That forever has changed.
You know what's interesting, Jamie? If you remember back in the late 60s, there was a time shift when we saw, even when growing up reading comics, that we saw a shift too. Vietnam is, 68 was a major turning point. And actually, I think in some ways, the beginning of the Frank Miller sort of mindset started in that late 60s with Marvel particularly. The complication of the heroes got more complicated, the social context of the Vietnam War. Marvel was probably the first to kind of get going in that direction in a larger format where you start to see heroes having a few more problems and having to deal with a lot of other issues.
Well, that's because there's several reasons for that, and not sociological reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The Comics Code Authority had relaxed its standards by that time.
There's that's a Comics right, yeah. Code Authority? Oh, yeah. What's a Comics Code Authority?
In the early 50s, Estes Kefauver was running his hearing on who's a communist and taking a show on the road, much like McCarthy.
Yep.
And then Kefauver didn't stop there. He went after the mob, and he didn't stop there. He went after juvenile delinquency, and comic books suddenly became, they were on the radar.
Yep.
And
it's like rap music.
Right.
It's like, remember the rap music Senate
exactly.
hearings.
Well, this comic books were the rap music of their decade. They had the industry tried to police itself and institute a public code, in other words, a stamp on a book, that was within their purview, and that wasn't enough. Their government pressure forced an independent authority to take control that the comic books didn't have any power over, and that stamp would be placed on comic books in print form.
Yep.
And that went on until just a few years ago. But during this period, we're watching Women's Lib. Now women have become more independent, and that has put pressure on the stability of marriages, not because the women are wrong. It's because they're finally right.
Yeah.
They can leave an abusive household.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they decide they didn't need to get married. They didn't need. Well, that's part of the change. I'm not going to call it a bad change or a good change.
Yeah.
It's just a change.
Yeah.
But all these things in our generation, in our time, affected the next generation of families. And so now you had kids who see things differently. They're not raised in a protective bubble, much like I felt I was.
Yeah,
and they're edgier. Their desires are edgier. Their desires are troubled. And comic books were written by older people, but people who were not necessarily from my generation anymore. They were also being written by guys who were affected by all the changes in the 60s and 70s. And they understood what the kids wanted.
Right.
And so they're writing for those kids, and they're giving them what they wanted. And so by the late 80s, early 90s, it was just a matter of time that comic books would reflect the views of the people who were reading them. They were done with Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane.
Yeah.
They wanted Spawn and Angela, and they wanted real, real...
much darker.
Morally confused characters because they're morally confused.
Yeah, morally and ethically. These kids today really struggle with... the clear sense of right and wrong, a clear sense of, even in society, just how they conduct themselves, what they just, it's a much more complicated world they live in, unfortunately. But it's also, I think sometimes we forget the responsibility of the media in this. We've talked about this with regard to news media, but also, even within comic books, kids will reflect back in the real world what they read or what they see. So use the term genuflection. And so if you see Madonna, and then people want to be Madonna, or people want to act out what they think is normal in society. So if what you portray as being normal is, everybody's screwed up and the world is all jacked up and, people are all got these other issues, then people will emulate that.
But at what point does the artist have a responsibility to think about other kids, other people's children, as opposed to thinking about the quality of his art and what he wants to put
out
there?
Ask the video game industry.
Yeah,
they're
the
ones who took it in the shorts over. They're having to force a rating system on it, parental advisories.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That they've been through what the comic books...
And it's amazing. You don't think about those things until you have kids.
Right.
There's a lot of things you don't think... You just... can easily kind of go, you can be very dismissive about until you have a kid. And now my wife and I, because we've got our almost 2-year-old now, we think, well, he's never going to use paper, right? I already have nieces and nephews that are in school, and they don't use paper.
Yeah.
I remember Peachy notebooks. I wonder if people are going to start collecting Peachy. When are they going to go out of business? Because nobody uses paper anymore.
Son, we call them Peachy folders.
Oh, I'm sorry, Peachy folders. See what I mean? See what I mean? I stopped using paper in college. But nobody uses paper anymore. So, I don't know. You just talk about a massive kind of cultural shift that way. And that's kind of I think, what a lot of this sort of represents. I mean, there's a nostalgia to it, right? I mean, and that's what a lot of your clientele's coming here for is because of the nostalgia. But then how does that moral ambiguity communicate? How do you communicate that to these kids in a way that is easy for them to understand and won't, kind of send them off in another direction that maybe the parents don't want them to go off into?
They're not interested, and that lack of interest is the key to correcting the future of comic books, and we don't know what the answer is.
So you were talking about those were congressional hearings that were on the road?
Right.
Those were congressional hearings.
Good time.
Yeah.
People say, I can't imagine that, but then you remember the rap music
in the 90s. The comic industry in the 50s. In the early 50s, in fact, up until the late 50s, from the early 50s to the late 50s, there was a period of time in there where comics almost went out of business. I mean, they really almost killed the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they
other
had
than
simply
just basic horror story, but no, you didn't mysteries and horrors all you got. You didn't get to see superheroes. They almost disappeared from the face of the earth for about five, 6 years.
What happened was the the wartime generation that drove superheroes from World War II, when they came back home, they had changed. And they wanted grittier, edgier stuff. So this is not what we're going through now with the lack of children and their decisions on how they entertain themselves and how they don't seem to be entertained by comic books like we were. This is not the first precedent. The precedent was set back in the late 40s, early 50s. Returning war vets and war vets headed to Korea, they wanted Westerns. They wanted horror. They wanted science fiction.
Yeah.
A lot of them actually just showed no interest in superheroes. They mm-hmm. Disney's and funny animals, spoof comic books, all this stuff superseded and dominated for quite a while. The problem was is that the crime comic books and the graphic horror and science fiction comic books drew the attention of these congressional hearings because of their graphic nature, where nowadays they'd be lukewarm reception.
Yeah.
Back then it was as shocking as if Playboy was when they came around and nude magazines were on sale.
But do you think maybe it really had more to do with the content they could deal with? Can you deal more with hot political topics within kind of the sci-fi genre than you can within the superhero genre?
Right. They were dealing with... Some companies were actually dealing with moral fable stories, and they didn't have any restrictions, so you could end the story on a gory note. That was
I think of that the Sci-Fi Channel has that show Continuum, right?
Yeah.
And it's about this plutocratic dystopia in the future, and somebody comes back to today, and then how she kind of fighting crime and. But the real issue there is that the interesting backstory on that is that they're questioning who's a terrorist and what is terrorism, and when they actually are questioning when is it okay to be a terrorist and what does the future hold for. And that show is based in Canada, so they're talking about Canadian politics and things like that. But my question, so that's kind of a good example of something dealing with content that's probably a lot touchier right off the bat. Do you think politicians and people that were doing this were seeing that this sci-fi content was more about these kind of political hot topics as opposed to necessarily just the gory?
They were seeing what they wanted to see. This was just like what we're experiencing with our mayor under duress. Is that sides are being
under
choked.
Duress or a dress
under a under a dress
under a under duress? Duress.
They were sides have been chosen. The battle has begun, and at some point, it isn't even about Filner. It's about power positioning to get somebody into that office that they thought should have been in there in the first place.
Yeah.
And so with the Kefauver congressional hearings, and as we've seen with rock and roll music and gaming and rap, sides had been chosen. Mm-hmm. They were exploiting a minor conundrum for very topical reasons, juvenile delinquency, war comic books contributing, and these guys were just playing politics with something. It's almost like a MacGuffin. If it hadn't have been comics, it would have been something else.
Yeah.
It's simply a MacGuffin.
Yeah.
It just needed a thing, and this guy needed to propel his political career forward, and he was picking at anything, typical Bible Belt, ultra-religious conservative from the 50s.
Yeah.
He just picked on everything that he didn't believe in.
Yeah.
And so comic books back then were weakened, and like Rick said, the content had been reduced to drivel, which didn't appeal to that generation. But by this time, a new generation of war babies were looking at comics, and they were looking at their dad's old comic books from the 40s, and they liked Superman and Batman, but they didn't have that in any real capacity like they did back then.
Yeah.
And the comic book industry sensed this. So by 1956, they experimented with a resurgence of comic book characters that had... been around since the 40s, and now they tooled them up and changed them a bit for this new generation, and it was a hit.
Yeah.
And that that episode in 1956, this one comic book, changed everything and is still affecting comic books today. It all sprung from that one well. So regardless, you were asking me how the comic book industry is surviving against the digital media. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We're inundated with too much competition, both digitally and at the store level. There are just too many little mom-and-pop stores that are occupied by guys who have no business running a store, but they're all over the place in every city. And you've got not enough readers to justify all these stores. And so you see comic book readership is being diffused throughout all this, and then the Internet is killing it.
Yeah. This was, you were telling me last week how comics were your kind of how you got into reading as a kid.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, it's interesting. I thought about the late 50s when they came about. That one of the things that changed was you had the nuclear age also sent us, and the space race changed comic books too in the late 50s, early 60s, where before the 40s superheroes were all like Earth-based, you know, for the most part. By late 50s, early 60s, we get into space, and everybody's got spacemen and spacesuits and all those famous B-movies that came out that really changed the face of comics. It actually leaves the Fantastic Four go out into space, and then there are cosmic rays, and then boom, they come back as something else. And so you start to see a different sort of world evolving for the baby boomer generation after World War II. But in that, I was fascinated with space and spaceship in the future, and you know, I started reading. I remember, I was like literally like 8 or 9 years old, and there was a Northern Lights where we were looking out the window one night, and my mom was like, "What's that?" And I said, "Oh, Mom, that's an Aurora Borealis." She looked at me like, "Oh, my God, my son's a genius." Literally, she knew how screwed up I really was. But for that one brief moment, my mother thought I was a genius.
You faked her out for just a little bit.
Exactly, just for a moment. But she said, "How'd you know that?" I said, "It's in Superman." And it was. Read about a Superman comic. And in that comic, there was this Superman's going up looking at this Aurora Borealis. And she was just, you know, I mean, so it's amazing. But also was a time where I looked and I saw something visually that I wanted to understand. I wanted to know what it said. So that's how I learned to read. I mean, I learned to read very young because I was so fascinated by the visual context.
Do you think kids are learning to read in that way these days? That's not how I learned to read.
You mean they can
I learned
read
to read because read. By brute force from my parents. Seriously, you know, that was my father's way of teaching me to read, was sitting me down and forcing me to read.
They're not reading comic books, so I don't know. I don't know what kids are attracted to get them to read voluntarily.
Well, this seems like something that would be more attractive to boys, teaching boys to read.
Well, if you look at us.
Than young girls.
When we were kids, they produced a lot of comic books for girls. Yeah. And then romance. They didn't. Mm-hmm. Simple as that. Then they stopped.
Yeah.
And so boys, yeah, sure. It's all about all of that stuff that we were thrilled with. Writers back in the 60s working on science fiction titles and even characters that were space-based like Green Lantern were actually professional science fiction writers and had just found that they could produce a regular paycheck off comic books, but they wrote sci-fi stories, guys like Gardner Fox and John Broome. Yeah. And the editor-in-chief at DC Comic Books, a guy named Julius Schwartz, had come up the ranks in the 30s as a literary agent for science fiction writers. Ray Bradbury was one of his closest friends, and he represented Ray Bradbury in his infancy as a writer. So you had that kind of stimulation for guys like us. Of course, if you're a sci-fi kid, you could not read comic books. Yeah. You had to read them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, I have no idea. When you look at the subject matter, the kids would never get it.
Yeah.
The plot devices and the maturity of the plots are well above what a kid, even a bright kid, would have problems with concepts of male-female dynamics or just the politics and fantasies of comic books. There are comic books that are produced for small kids. They're regular. It's almost like an afterthought with the industry that they have to produce this stuff.
Yeah. You can tell in their
It's a lost leader for them.
Yeah.
But there are really very few signs that the kids are reading them because they're almost always exclusively based on cartoons. They're rarely ever an Archie comic style character that has no basis in anything other than comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Now everything is based on cartoons, and the kids can't get enough of whatever's hot, the regular show right now or The Simpsons.
Yeah.
They'll simply, "Hey, do they make a regular show comic book?" And we go, "Yeah, we got it right over here." And they walk up there and they hit the brakes when they realize this is a $3 or $4 comic book. They're, "What?" And the parents are not interested in spending that kind of money on something that's going to be destroyed in all likelihood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you have to, you have a 2-year-old. I have a bouncing baby 35-year-old. Now, I don't know what little kids want to be occupied with. I got to figure that toys is a, the toys are a cultural form of entertainment that will never go out of fashion and can't be digitized. Mm-hmm. Video games are a form of a toy, but frankly, these things still have that tactile draw that require, that kids got to have.
Yeah.
So they won't go out of business, but I don't know what kids read. I don't know if they want to
That's
read.
Kind of a funny thing for you to say, seeing how you own a comic book store, that you don't know what kids read, that you would think that this would be the place to come to learn what kids are interested in.
Parents come in here with their kids, and like I said, the kid is playing with his iPad, and the parents are reading the comics. And the kids don't can't wait to get out of here.
Yeah.
They don't have any interest. The parents can't get their kids to read, and yet logically, it is the thing that the parents should be doing, because every kid advances if they're educated.
Yeah.
Every kid advances faster if they're educated earlier.
Yep.
And every kid's comprehension development is greater if their reading comprehension is well endowed.
Yeah.
So if you give a kid who's 4 or 5 a comic book and he reads words that he's not exposed to at the elementary school level, that kid's already ahead.
Yeah.
He's the next Aurora Borealis chatterer.
Which
but I got parents who come in here, man, and they lament that their relatives won't let their kids, or the neighbors won't let their kids read comics, because there's some feeling that the comic book is juvenile, or it's crass, and it's an insult, and kids should be reading books.
Well, my father was that way when I was younger.
Yeah, it's too bad, though, because it's
and the irony is that I end up going to art school in college instead of going to. He's forgiven me, and you know what? I'm not angry at him, because he did what he thought was best.
Yeah, absolutely.
At that time, and he was worried, like, you're not going to learn to read unless I force you to read.
Right.
You know, and so he just sat me down and forced me to read. So I learned through brute force, but most people don't. Most parents are not that way, And
well, you know, it would be great. It'd be great if
and now I think his mind is totally different. I think he's completely shifted gears.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, he's gotten old. Easier. He's chilled out a little bit.
Okay. I was going to say, it'd be interesting. It's too bad that the Silver Age stuff is so expensive, because I think the kids would enjoy the kids between, let's say 7 or 8 and, up until, 12 or 13 or whatever, would enjoy the context, and it's not too mature, but it's not as trivial as the kid comics are today.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I bought some for Lorenzo, my son, and he was 6 and a half, and I remember I got a couple of kiddie comics, and he's just like, what is this? I've got them still, but he doesn't care about those, because they're not nearly as engaging as the ones that when we read when we were kids.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They were just better
so
reads.
They're kind of they're dismissive about them. They're totally afterthoughts.
So
do you think that the comic book industry should feel more responsibility towards the literacy?
I don't believe that the comic book industry is doing anything wrong in this one regard.
Mm-hmm.
I think the comic book industry is trying to make a profit, and if they sensed there was money in it, they would be jovial about helping children.
It's
just
a business.
Nothing there.
Yeah.
They've tried, they've experimented on numerous occasions, doing all kinds of things, and they just can't get it to stick.
Yeah.
And I think the fundamental problem is at the family level. If parents encourage their kids to read comic books, then there would be thousands and thousands of kids reading comic books that don't read now.
Yeah.
But there is just a detachment from this generation, the bringing up children, who are not encouraging their kids to read comic books.
Yeah.
They all want to line up at the Mission Valley Cinemas to watch the movies, the comic book movies.
Yeah.
But that's as far as they're willing to go. It's just no interest in reading.
And this is the generation after Jamie and I, too. So it's the parents of kids now were children themselves in the 80s. So your view of the picture is much different than our view. That even though it's been only a little over a decade and changed away, the fact is that it really that 10 to 15 year period was significant in terms of the, you know, how you socialized and interacted with the venue of comics. And what you thought about comics was very different than what we thought about comics during that time. Had a lot to do with the electronic age, really maturing, computers coming on, a lot of things changed in that period that were significant to that actually taking place, which I think is a pretty fascinating thing. I think the thing that's going to be interesting about this whole story is going to be the question of, like, you know, most things happen in cycles. Mm-hmm. And whether or not the cycle of comics is the way we understood it, it won't look exactly the same, whether it will come full circle, whether the baby boomers, as we start to slowly start to die off in the next, you know, hopefully 30, 40 years. You know, yeah, 50 or 60 years. that after that, that people will come to appreciate, again, the written word and of what we have in front of us and recognize the significance and importance of it. Because it is important. I still think it's important.
Do comic book stores in San Diego have any pull politically with regard to, like, Comic-Con and big, that one particular big event? Does that give you guys a little bit more power at City Hall at all?
No. Comic-Con is autonomous. No one has any impact on that organization. They are only influenced by the Hollywood aspect of this. There are all kinds of rumors that circulate about Comic-Con and how it runs, how many people are paid versus volunteers, who's responsible for what aspect of con. And one of the rumors that I've heard more often than once, than a lot, is that of the staffing paid through this nonprofit organization, a good percentage of it is only on staff to run the Hollywood aspect of the show. I'm an exhibitor at that show. I have two booths. The cost of the booths and my overhead is roughly $6,500 for the week. And that $6,500, that's a lot of money to put out. So I require some things from Comic-Con to have a smooth show. And they are, I have gripes to pick with those guys. I've written them down. I've aired them before, and I'll do again if you want to hear them. But the problem is there's no one who's in charge of my end of the building at the exhibition hall who would ever be influenced by anything I said.
So the people that are in charge of the comics part of Comic-Con don't understand comics. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, there's just no draw for them to give us the same amount of attention and help that they give the other end of the building. Mm-hmm. For instance, security. They have multiple security entities there, and yet the threat of shoplifting and the consistency of shoplifting is enormous.
Oh, wow.
And they do nothing proactive to stop it. We're all victims.
Well, you're a retired cop. How would you fix?
Oh, we've already fixed it.
Oh.
We hire retired cops.
Yeah.
On a bunch of the exhibitors pool money together. We've done this, and we're doing it again this year.
Uh-huh.
We hire one or two retired cops, and they either work one or two booths exclusively, or they work an area exclusively, undercover the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And it has worked. And you would be at a show with, let's say, 50 back-issue dealers. By the end of the show, 25 of them got ripped off. That was a consistent problem, and it's all shoplifting in the room. As of the last year or two, that has diminished to zero, where none of the guys who get typically ripped off have been ripped off.
Because you've got these undercover.
But you guys
have to pay for it.
Yeah, but it's nominal. Split it up with a dozen guys.
But it only took two.
Right.
That's it. If it's a nominal expense, why aren't the organizers?
Yeah, they put out a bulletin announcing that the CSC, I think they called, is, that replaced Elite Security on one side.
Yeah. I think they're the ones that have the contract.
And as a retired cop, I think these guys are buffoons.
Mm-hmm.
And they're over the top. Mm-hmm. They're just wrong. I've seen them in action. Yeah. They are wrong.
Yeah.
But they put out a memo that said that there would be no independent security services in the convention room without permission from this organization. Well, your organization, because all you're doing is scaring off our first line of defense, and then you won't come in and replace them. We're still on our own.
So was this year
that
they did that? So they're telling you that they have security and you can't bring any other security in.
Right.
But you're going to go ahead and bring in your
own
security.
And you know who runs this company?
No.
A retired San Diego cop. I used to work around.
Wow.
I'm not going to throw any names out.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's been the previous security company, Elite Security, the guys in the red jackets,
yeah.
mm-hmm. also run, not owned by, but run by, a whole bunch of retired San Diego cops.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a better grasp. They were no more effective at preventing theft,
mm-hmm.
but they were a lot more practical about how to run a room if there was a problem,
yeah.
or how not to create problems like this current security service does
yeah.
by their aggressive nature.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, nobody that I know has any influence on the con. And there are a lot of wealthy
mm-hmm.
store owners and guys who set up at these shows who by their financial position you'd think would have some pull,
yeah.
but nothing.
Yeah.
We got nothing.
It could be like in Germany or in Israel where you walk around with automatic weapons up and down the aisles, which is probably what would happen.
Let me tell you how many guns are in that room when I'm around and my peers.
Yeah.
I got probation. I got state parole, county probation, county parole. I have federal agents and all kinds of guys who are all armed who helped me out.
Yep.
And I'm armed because I retired. But I don't bring it into the room
because
it's just one more thing I'd have to worry about.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
The con itself, as long as we're on the subject, I'll give you an example of what you wanted to know about influence.
Yeah.
Okay, you have one chance at exerting influence at the con, just one. That is the feedback session where you as an exhibitor mm-hmm. can go to con authorities
yeah.
in a meeting room
uh-huh.
and air your grievances, which is fine,
yeah.
except for one big problem. You have from 3 to 4 on Sunday afternoon to go head them off. Just happens to be the same time all of us are in long lines to register for the following year, and it is also one of the most active points for shoplifting.
Wow.
So you can only leave your booth for one purpose, that's to get registered for next year, and then you have to rush back to your booth at between 3
wow.
and 4
wow.
on a Sunday.
How convenient.
Yeah.
yeah.
How convenient.
I think it's BS.
Yeah.
They should actually come up with, if they actually care, but again, with no one has any influence on them,
yeah.
and they're running roughshod over the city.
Yeah.
They actually had the city scared for a while about jumping mm-hmm. ship,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're just, these guys are autonomous. They fear nothing.
I mean, it's funny, too, because for me, I've always thought that more than half of the experience isn't in it's being able to walk around downtown. That's like a huge part of Comic-Con for me.
And it's free to do that.
And it's free to do that. It's to be downtown.
Yeah.
You can't go to Anaheim and get that.
No.
Anaheim Convention Center, you're not going to have the same experience.
Nope.
And that's the thing that the city has. There's no other place in Southern California, I don't think, where you can have that convention center close to that downtown center with
yeah.
that
they
kind of massive... It takes over that entire area.
Yeah.
You can't do that in L.A. You can't do that in Anaheim. You can't do that anywhere.
And so
the city's got a lot more pull, I think, than they want to admit that
have. Yeah, I'll put this in perspective. I sat down with one of the comic convention paid board members who had power within that group who has since departed. I'm not going to mention this person's name. But we sat down at a show in Los Angeles. We were just happened to bump into each other, and we talked. And this person was telling me that they had already shopped Vegas,
mm-hmm.
Anaheim, and L.A. for this jump ship thing. This was years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd already done it and delineated the negatives for each one of these,
mm-hmm.
with Anaheim being this massive parking lot.
Yeah.
And
it would
just,
lose everything
right.
it has now.
It
would just simply go out the window.
Anaheim yeah. has its right now. They've transplanted a San Francisco show called WonderCon,
where yeah.
San Francisco's convention center goes through refurbishment.
Mm-hmm.
They've transplanted it to Anaheim. I've been to the Anaheim place. It is it looks, the convention center would obviously work, except the Comic-Con people didn't like the way it was designed. This huge outdoor area in the middle of the convention center didn't suit their needs. The way it was buttressed, it wasn't there, didn't want to do it.
No.
Also, it is just this massive, pretty industrial park area with hotels. The amenities were there, but too much conflict.
Yeah, it's not like you can hop on the trolley. And, I mean, it's really... And Vegas is, I've been to Vegas for other things, and that would be another nightmare, too.
Vegas was addressed. They've tried shows there, not Comic-Con, but other Comic-Con shows have started. Now there was a one earlier this season that started up again, mm-hmm. And they're trying to make it. But we're talking July in Vegas.
Yeah.
Forget it.
Yeah.
And then finally... I'm not even going to go into downtown L.A.
That would be a nightmare.
Then I would carry my gun. But then there was the talk about San Francisco, and San Francisco, the show I mentioned, WonderCon, mm-hmm. was an independent show until Comic-Con began. They own it now.
Yeah.
And so they already have a show up there. I don't know if they feel like they need to compete.
Now, WonderCon's more about books, though.
WonderCon's the same thing. It may have started one way, but it looks the same.
They all start
to look the same. The bottom line with this talk was, and it's the reason Comic-Con is here in San Diego, was that the guys who started Comic-Con, they had all moved here from all over the country as youths or as older kids, mm-hmm. or even younger adults. For the same reasons anybody else moves to San Diego. Back in the 60s and 50s, there were jobs here. Their families want to relocate to mild weather. Yeah. And they start this show up, and everyone starts coming because they want to take a vacation, affordable vacation, to San Diego during July when the rest of the country sucks.
Yeah.
And they're happy here.
Yeah.
And San Diego has built the amenities around that convention center, so that it isn't the hole it used to be when it was at the El Cortez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's all inclusive, and you don't have to walk out of downtown, and you are fully enveloped for 4 or 5 days, and you're happy.
Yeah.
And if you're not happy, SeaWorld and the zoo and all those, the ancillary forms of entertainment for your family who may not want to go in, and it's all there within taxi distance.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to leave San Diego. They still want to leave. The convention, I don't know how many of the employees work and live in San Diego. I used to. That used to be all of them, but now I don't know.
Yeah.
So there may be one or two voices on that committee that lives and that works in L.A. and says, I don't want to have to come down here anymore. But frankly, if you lived in L.A. and you got a chance to spend a week in San Diego, would you want to move your show up to Los Angeles or keep it here? They're all about the money, and if they can't make more money because of the convention center and the expansion, well, what are you going to do? There's all kinds of ideas floated about mini cons or branches of the con that are spread out around the hotels around there. What's the one just south of the con? Is that
The
Hilton?
Is that the Hilton?
Is that the Hilton with the two
silver towers?
Well, that's west.
Yeah, south.
East.
Then there's the.
There's a Hilton there. The one that used to high top the Hilton.
That's where actually.
We recorded right behind the
Fox Grill is right there, and then there's a big.
Where the bridge is. Okay, now you know that they've got a lot of the events, and that there has been some conflict with Comic-Con about how much of that stuff is floating out of their control and into the control of these hotels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the con is not happy about losing control because they're also losing whatever financial benefit comes from that.
But if
you have to take over Petco Park because you can't float something into the convention center, then so be it.
But the thing too about that is that these events are out in the city as well. And that's part of, I think, the real draw to Comic-Con, that you go to the parking lot at Petco Park, and it's taken over by whatever, and that has nothing to do with the convention part of it.
Correct.
You know, you can do the zombie obstacle course at Petco if you want to and not have tickets to Comic-Con. You can go just walk down Fifth Avenue and just every restaurant, every cafe, and that's part of it as well. And I think it is a lot more like, in that sense, it's a lot more like these big like film festivals in Europe when you go to those. I've been to Cannes and the one in Berlin, and that's what happens there, too. all the little theaters.
Oh, dude.
All the little theaters turn into little theaters. Have your main theater, but then you've got all this stuff that's going on outside of that. It's great.
I interrupt you real quick because I got something for you.
Uh-oh. Okay. Oh, no. I saw you smirk. I'm a little afraid.
Dude, I have the name of your segment.
Oh, yeah.
From con
to con.
Con. C-A-N.
From con to con.
I just
okay.
That's perfect.
You know,
they do that.
Diego,
yeah.
This street scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a street scene like no one's ever seen, but somehow somebody is resistant to let the street scene of it expand like it's supposed to.
Is that like the city council people? Is that political?
Is
that the restaurant owners, East Village Association?
Several blocks of Fifth and a couple of streets.
Yeah.
And you remember they've moved street scene out.
Yeah, they took it out, and then it died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They moved it out to the stadium.
And I don't know if you can figure out why they moved it, whatever that real reason was.
Well,
that's why this Comic-Con venture isn't growing outside further, because by fencing the entire downtown off like
they
did the street scene.
Part of the reason, I know one of the major reasons they moved it was because none of the people that went to street scene actually went into shops and bought anything. But the Comic-Con attendees and people who come for that, they buy things.
Right. Yeah.
And then street scene, you had drunks and fights and all kinds of stuff.
Right, and you had
Comic-Con,
to pay to get
I've
in.
Talked to, yeah, and you had to pay to get in. And I've talked to Lansdowne, and he's told me it's like the only convention that they have in town where the streets are cleaner when people leave.
Right.
Because nerds are nice. You know? Let's just face it, they're not going to mess up your city. You know. So, and they buy things.
Right.
You know, they show up with money, they spend money, they eat out, they do all and they don't make a horrible mess.
And it seems to me,
and if they're safe. I remember the stabbing. And how funny that was.
You talk about the pencils?
Yeah, and how it started off as being the stabbing at Comic-Con, and it turned out to be one guy wrote on another guy on accident, and then some other person freaked out,
and that was it.
That was the big stabbing at Comic-Con.
You got lead poisoning and...
No, it was a Sharpie. It was an autographed Sharpie that happened to be red.
Uh-oh.
And one guy bumped into another guy's Sharpie, and then somebody... And then they went, hey, and then somebody screamed, he stabbed him, and he'd written up, and this poor guy with the Sharpie got arrested and drug out of there in handcuffs and booked, and then once they talked to him for 15 minutes, they realized he just bonked into this other guy and happened to have a red Sharpie, and then they let him go, but this poor guy, in the meantime, got totally humiliated, and was all over national TV, because everybody wanted to know about the stabbing, and it turned out to be nothing.
You have to address the fact that
which has me worried about Metallica playing Comic-Con, because
that's going to be great. They might as well just, see, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Comic-Con's evolution is such that it's going to have to block off a portion of downtown, and it's going to be a form of street scene.
Mm-hmm.
No more screwing around. You're going to not have to fence it off. You're simply going to barricade portions off so there's no paid admittance. Nobody needs to pay twice to go to con.
No.
Once to get into the neighborhood, once to get into the show.
Yeah.
But they already had a problem last year, an incident, which is proof that this has to happen. And that was the day one of the attendees got nailed by a car running across.
Yeah,
got
that poor woman tripped and fell.
And got smashed right in Harbor Drive.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is you can't put trains, planes, and automobiles in this area anymore during the con because the traffic doesn't belong there. You realize I need to cross the street, for instance, at the end of the show.
Yeah.
I need to walk across Harbor Drive.
Mm-hmm.
There are 4,000 people standing there with me.
Yeah.
It takes 15 minutes to catch a light because of traffic where I can cross the street on 5th.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
They should just stop Harbor
Drive. It should be shut down.
Yeah.
You have one point of egress and one point of ingress at either end where you can enter the parking garage.
Yeah.
But that center portion, you don't need to be there.
Exactly.
Cars
mm-hmm.
don't need to go. They don't need to go there. They can go down Broadway or Market and catch what they need to catch or on the other side of Petco Park.
Yeah.
And they also need to shut down a portion of 3rd and a portion of 4th on either side, or on either side of 5th or 6th, just like street scene, and let it happen.
Yeah.
I know Tony Young was trying to do a lot of that for a while until he ended up resigning for this Red Cross gig, and nobody wanted to work with him on it. Why can't the city council get together to do this, seeing how this is such a huge... financial boon.
I'm going to put on my Mayor Filner cap.
I wish we had a mask for you.
Filner, is obviously in tune with this, because several months ago he had been interviewed about this Comic-Con thing, and he was so enthused with it. He wanted somebody within the city to create a comic book museum, a permanent display that would be in that area to celebrate this city's enthusiasm, its placement, and the history of comic books. You know, you got plenty of people who could contribute and be a part of it.
We're historical figures.
Yeah, and so, you know, and Filner was...
And so humble.
I know.
Yeah.
But you heard it. There was no response from the other politicians.
Yeah.
This was...
Why not?
There might have been one.
Why not? Why do you think not?
Because I don't think they take it seriously.
Yeah.
I think that outside...
But when Comic-Con wants to leave, they take it seriously.
They take it seriously, but not...
Signs.
But, yeah, it's only the money. Yeah. There's no... If they saw a major profit... We're not celebrating comics for profit at the museum level.
Yeah,
so there'd be no point.
Yeah.
They just see an unnecessary appliance to a thing that they don't understand in the first place. Unless you had some comic book guy on the city council who could attribute a little bit of attention to it and figure out how to exploit this con for longer than the given week, do more with it, you might find that the city could actually develop a bigger, not only a bigger fan base, but a bigger customer base for all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have a... You got a show in Mission Valley. It was the startup show last year with original Comic-Con guys. And they're tentatively putting on their second show this fall.
Oh.
I'm hoping that they still have to... This is up to them to figure out how to afford it and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can continue to get another show like that going and other things to go with it, man, it's just... Accept your fate, San Diego.
Yeah.
You're the comic book mecca of the entire planet, so you might as well just accept your fate and have more of it celebrated year-round.
You know, it's interesting. Remember, remember back in our day, New York is where all this stuff happened.
Right.
You know, DC Comics, Marvel were all based in New York. Now a lot of it's based out in L.A., and so Image Comics is down in San Diego. I mean,
La Jolla
has gone, but I mean, it was in La Jolla when it first started up.
Yeah, Wildstorm was here.
Wildstorm was here, yeah.
We have one major comic book publisher here, IDW.
Yeah.
They're over in Bay Park.
Yeah.
Those guys have put out a lot of phenomenal product. They do a lot of licensing from television material and other successful comic book themes from the past. But San Diego used to be much more dominant as far as the creators were here.
Mm-hmm.
But L.A. is the big draw.
Yeah.
And that's where, just like when we were kids, it was all in New York. Now it's in New York and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It would be nice to see San Diego harbor publishers and more year-round. But I don't think we'll be able to go that way. We'd have to find something else commercial to celebrate comic books in San Diego.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially with Hollywood being what Hollywood is, and let's face it, they're all pandering to Hollywood because that's where they grow from. But
the thing
about the people, even if people come to con, so many of them dress up to do what they do, but a lot of them, even though they dress up, couldn't tell, like, you know, we grew up watching Star Trek, and many of them dress up looking like Star Trek characters, but if you ask them about a lot of the stuff, a lot of people who dress up don't know the content. They don't know, so a lot of them don't know the backstory. You know, it's like they're
not nerdy enough for you.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, it's like some people.
We have a Klingon family that we have on the show every year, and these people are full on Trekkie nerds, and they like raise their kids in this. It's funny, they bring their little Klingon kids
so that
they dress them up, and the Klingon kids know, you know, because you know they're seven, so they haven't had an opportunity to see as much Star Trek as their parents, but they know some stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, I haven't encountered that. I haven't. Do you try and start conversations with the people in character?
Well, I've engaged a couple of them a few times and find out how little they really know about it because they're not old enough yet. I mean, I met Leonard Nimoy twice actually in my life.
Yeah, yeah. He's supposed to be very very humble.
Oh, he
guy.
Was great. He was great. I was on a run up by UCLA. I went to UCLA, and I on a run, and there he was walking. About the I won't say where the hotel was. So I respect that, but he was and you know, and the woman I was running with said, "That's Mr. Spock." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah." And he turned around and said, you know, I said, "Hi, how are you?" You know, he said, "Great." You know, and back when I worked at Rockwell, he had come to, when they were talking about the space shuttle program, he actually came and did a discussion at Rockwell International back in the 80s. And so then that's what happened. He ended up being my land. He was a part owner in an apartment complex I lived in Los Angeles. So out of run, I couldn't get away from Leonard Nimoy, which was really cool because I'm a big Mr. Spock fan.
What did you think of the new Star Trek?
You know what? Strangely enough, I liked it better than I thought I would. I actually liked it better than the first one, to be honest with you. And I didn't think I was going to like it better than the first
one. I like the way they were able to reset that whole timeline there and just start over.
Yeah, I was the only thing trying to trip me a little bit was the Enterprise being underwater. I think that surprised a few people. Who, you know, I mean, that, I guess spaceships can go underwater now. I just, that part I didn't quite get, but the rest of it, I actually really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Jamie?
Oh yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm not a harsh critic of comic book or sci-fi movies. No. I'm really forgiving.
Yeah.
I think that our industry is on troubled ground as a comic book writer or as a comic book retailer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anything that promotes comic books, I'm there for.
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, there's a fragility to all this, and it can be broken by the amount of negative publicity movies get.
Right.
Some of the studios stopped setting up at Comic-Con. And when asked why, they said, because now we're in constant communication with our fans face-to-face, and they just turn it around on us and blog the hell out of us negatively.
Yeah.
They said, there's a blowback to our presence at the con from all these people who adopt a bully pulpit on the net, doing things and saying things they would never say to our faces.
No.
But now they've got the entire world.
It's internet trolls.
Yeah. Right.
Studios are scared of internet trolls.
Disney stopped setting up.
Yeah.
They had a presence there, and last year they stopped.
Because of internet trolls?
It's an expense to set up then to be rewarded by harsh critics that just need a place to bully.
Yeah.
And I think that if you take an average comic book movie and you critique it because you don't care if you liked it or not, you just want to torture this movie because you have a voice you think matters, that the industry becomes much more sensitive to that.
Yeah.
Bad enough they have to pull, that the movie industry has to deal with pirating, which costs them millions and billions of dollars.
Yeah.
When you chip away at their support by critiquing everything they do, even a good movie gets hammered.
Yeah.
Running into a guy, for instance, who thinks Avengers was a bad movie. Are you crazy? But they do this because they can.
Then
they used to just say it face-to-face. Now they say it to, 300 million people.
Yeah. Well, they get money being the hater.
It does a disservice to all the attempts to popularize as best they can what I love.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a problem.
Hey, seeing Hulk take Loki and bash him around a few times, that was like the best scene ever. I thought that was best scene ever.
Nobody find that? Is there anybody on this planet who actually didn't like that scene?
Yeah. I've replayed it like a dozen times back and forth.
I like comic book movies that are, I think a lot of them have up until this last couple years, where Marvel and DC have both glommed on to a new format, a new way of telling a story.
Yeah.
The trilogies obviously work, and trilogies where the stories are connected works, and really putting your best effort into casting and developing plots that are not predictable.
Yeah.
Batman, the trilogy was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then with Marvel now linking everything together, and these guys finally caught the whirlwind after the blasé Daredevils and Fantastic Fours. The Spider-Man trilogy was the first kick; it really worked, but it seemed to lack a certain edge towards the end that now Marvel has completely adopted and adapted to their movies.
Yeah.
With their television show Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. coming out this fall, Marvel is poised to create a monster because they can take all the characters now that they own, their studio owns almost all of their characters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who's got Spider-Man right now. I don't know if Marvel still has it or if they bought it back from Sony. I don't know where some of these characters reside.
Mm-hmm.
But you think about all the characters that haven't been presented yet,
the
ones that may not show up in a future movie.
Mm-hmm.
Luke Cage, Iron Fist, some of these guys like Moon Knight, other characters that would really shine, at least on the television level.
Yeah.
Well, now they have essentially every episode of S.H.I.E.L.D. could be a character premiere that could somehow bounce to his own movie if he's received well.
Yeah.
It's just going to be, they're out of control with with what they can do from this humble little television show.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's really interesting. I'm curious what's going to happen with, I haven't seen the new Superman yet, which I'm embarrassed to say. I'm really dying to see it. I got to find some time to be able to squeeze in one to see it. But I also think that it's one of those things where, you know, how many, you know, DC has to be very careful. They've repackaged them several times now, and it's going to be interesting to see how if this new Superman gains traction with the public. You know, I think they're trying to make it a little darker edge. You know, it's certainly not as light and fluffy as.
No, this was a violent. This was a violent, darker movie where he's treated by. By the U.S. military as an enemy.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
An alien enemy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which came out of the comics. Out of the comics series,
You know, it was what DC figured out that they needed to do some rebooting along what Marvel's doing.
Yeah.
You've got to reach this generation that requires that.
Yeah.
The previous Superman movie was wonderful, Brandon Routh.
Yeah.
But it lacked what this... What apparently the same people who were driven to watch a Spawn movie want. They want a somewhat of a flawed character, an anti-hero.
Yeah, it's a darker
they
edge.
Can identify with.
Yeah, it's like the Battlestar Galacticas. Mm-hmm. You know, you remember the one from back when we were growing up? You know, we were, you know. And then you look at, which was, you know, I mean.
It's all models. They hired models for actors.
Exactly.
It looks silly.
Exactly. But the new one was much edgier, you know. I mean, so they've done, it's interesting how they've evolved, and what's happened is we have a much edgier, the genre of comics has gotten edgier and darker, and, you know, in some ways it's good because it's human, but it's also problem with because the kids can't read it because it's too grown up and too complicated for kids. And, you know, again, people read and they reflect what they see and what they hear and what they read. And so, you know, there is a psychological effect to that, which is unfortunate because people can't just synthesize it and go, oh, it's a comic book. Okay, let me get what I get from it and leave it there. But, you know, it also solicits a certain attitude and mood about, you know, just like music does, the same thing. So people synthesize information and they take it and they emulate what they hear, see, or touch. You know?
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff, though.
Yep. Yeah, it certainly is. We're almost at an hour and a half now.
Oops.
I'm not surprised you could talk for an hour and a half on comics.
You can edit out his part. You can
It'd be fine.
That's about three quarters of it.
Yeah,
exactly. You can cut me out. We'll just we'll go over to Excalibur, have a cigar, and we'll talk about real comics.
Yeah. All right. Well, until next time.